Welcome to Empowered, Mind-Body Inspiration. The mind is the map to wholeness, wellness, health. The heart is the key to genius and inspiration. Join me and my guests as we explore how to release and rewire into who you truly are, unique, whole, and empowered. Please like, share, and subscribe. Spiral up, spiral out.
Hello, everyone. Let's all welcome our guest, Math Eric. And Matthew, thank you for coming back. And if it's just my choice, our choice, we really want you to keep coming back. But I know many want you because you're just a wealth of knowledge. So for all of you out there, listen up, because you need to listen carefully behind and feel also Math Eric's energy behind his words, because there's so many information there and you could really get lost and you think you are in the right direction, but no, you are also being used emotionally and intellectually. And before you know it, you are part of this, whatever they call us or who, what they call us, the useless eaters. So Math Eric is the creator and editor-in-chief of the Canadian Patriot, and he and his lovely wife, Cynthia Chong, founded the Rising Tide Foundation, and they're both in Substack, I believe, and Substack is one of those most reliable source of information, again, and he's also the author of two series, and one is The Untold History of Canada. So for Canadians, listen up. I know you know Math, and if you don't, it's high time for you to know him. And then for the Americans, we also, he has written the book on the Americas, okay?
Oh, the clash.
And the third, yes, and the third one, he has it out already. And the third one is The Birth of a Eurasian Manifest Destiny. And I'll let Math explain all of that or have a brief description. Because, and Math, after you give a brief description, could you share that little story of a young patriot in your educational group, the Sunday, of what him and his family are doing with your books?
Oh, yeah. That's a completely, I was super happy to meet this young guy. He's 17, named Declan, and he's got a really great homeschool experience where him, his siblings, and his parents just happen to have like a really healthy little mini microculture, both for the family unit, but also for their network around a really healthy run church community in Texas. And it's just been a pleasure to work with this guy, because every week my group here, we set up little reading groups, study sessions, workshops to work through the writings of Plato, various original writings by great thinkers who made history, in order to, you know, get a sense of what is the universal character of great minds that tend to move things in an upward direction, that don't sort of accommodate the standards of normalcy or mediocrity that are generally, you know, dominant at any given phase of human civilization's history. So you tend to get these Da Vinci's, you get, you know, a Benjamin Franklin occasionally, you know, and people tend to treat these figures kind of like outliers. You know, that there's the norm of what humans are, and then there's these outliers, these exceptional beings that just, you can't fit them into, you can't explain what caused their exceptionalism from the standpoint of what was normal in their space and time that they existed in. There's like nothing in there to account for how these people stand out. And I mean, in my theory, and I don't think that's the right way of looking at it. I tend to think of, because most people tend to ignore when they look at history, the existence of a continuous oligarchical system that's been holding on like a parasite against the host, and which has worked very hard to create cultural dynamics of mediocrity that destroy our innate genius, our innate natural potential as we're born as babies, to explore, to be in wonder, to make discoveries, and to continue to make that process better into our old age. That should be, I think, the best definition of a human being is the search for the and acquisition of and sharing of wisdom and the pleasures associated with that. Not so much the pleasures of the flesh, which are fine in and of themselves, but they could be easily things that induce us into becoming cattle-like slaves if we're not aware of how they might dominate us, right? If we don't cultivate our wisdom, we will give in to the pleasures of the flesh inordinately to the point that we cause regret. You know, we've overeaten the cake, right? So we cause greater pains, and as such, we lose our own internal compass. And then we destroy, as we do that, our ability to be those geniuses, those great, and the word gets abused, right? Again, to be ourselves, just as natural beings made in the image of a creative God. So we ignore that oligarchical system. But I think when you think about people like Erasmus or Thomas More or, Kepler or any of these great minds, they're people who basically just made their pathway to their own cultivation their highest priority with a moral compass. And they wanted to make that process as transparent as possible for their fellow human beings, both in their time, but also afterwards, with a moral intent, which is why people like Benjamin Franklin is such a great example. We're going to be reading him soon, his autobiography and his works, his work on science and his experiments, playfully trying to figure out, well, what is behind this thing in the clouds that causes forest fires and things like that, this electricity, what is its nature? And by understanding it, can we harness a new force of the universe to the benefit and service of humankind? Now, he didn't see that as separate from his theory on economics, on his essay on the observation towards the increase of mankind in 1751, which was a wonderful economic treatise where he refutes British free trade, the British Empire's demands that the American colonies do not have access to protectionism because, you know, that's for the mother country to own all of the manufacturing that she acquired by destroying Indian textile mills and stuff, you know, which was the former primary productive zone of the world. The British Empire made sure that India wouldn't have that. She cut off the hands of tens of thousands of Indian laborers so that they couldn't actually make or practice their trade. And, you know, Britain used protectionism for herself, of course. She wasn't that dumb. In order to, you know, keep the markets to dominate the markets, but she would never allow it for her victims, whether in Ireland, whether in the Americas, whether in anywhere. That they all had to submit to open borders, you know, allow for the flooding of cheap goods to undercut your local markets, so that you would stay dependent upon a monopoly, a hegemon, a unipolar power, which was the British Empire.
May I please just interrupt by just, so when we mention the word eaters, useless eaters, is that something that someone just created, labeled, and call a certain group? Is it a group of, is it by class, economic class? Is it by lineage in terms of like bloodline or is it that something really that we have to accept, and what can we really do in terms of, as you are saying and have been saying all along in all your interviews, yeah, is transformation. So, because I think whatever we're learning now, whether it be at home or in public or in a group, it's so important to know, who are we, or who as an individual and as a human being?
Absolutely. And I'm setting the stage for that, because essentially the useless eaters, and I've got a few slides that begin with Yuval Noah Harari, who's a high priest of the World Economic Forum, who says something about his view of useless eaters. And he's trying to popularize that on behalf of his owners, which is ugly. Useless eaters, though, you'll see essentially applies to everybody who does not access the side of their natural identity, which is in alignment with the love of wisdom, which is what we actually are. To the degree that we don't get access to, we can't tap into that source, the effect of our lives are going to cause a system to break down over time. And as such, as the system breaks down that supports human life over time, if we're not being creative in the most fruitful way, it will result in a reduced ability to support life. And as such, there will be certain consequences that those with power and bad intentions will utilize an objective crisis of scarcity to argue that certain parts of the population can no longer be maintained, kind of like cattle. Now, that's something which, again, Benjamin Franklin in 1751, in his observations on the increases of mankind, as well as his earlier 1729 on the necessity for a paper currency calling for a colonial script to have economic independence for the colonies. He was refuting this in both theory, in his written form, that no, human beings actually don't have these limits. If you give them opportunities and if you give the nations that they organize themselves in the ability to defend themselves and to cultivate their own backyards, hence protectionism. You need to protect, you know, your every nation state to be a nation state. Even before there were nation states in the colonies, he was saying we need to have the right for manufacturing to stand on our own two feet. Because when you have that, you have a greater spectrum of opportunity to discover the brilliance of the minds of the people who no longer have to just labor as brute animals on a plantation. And that's good to discover new skills, you know, and you make new discoveries and inventions. Now, that was the theory. In the practice, he was discovering, he leapfrogged every single great mind of Europe who was like arrogant and prideful that they were so advanced, the best, you know, expressions of mind in the world were these European scientists who couldn't discover the thing that this guy with a grade three education across the pond of the backwaters of the United States that nobody respected back then, you know, what are these colonies on the outside of the world, right? He was able to leapfrog all of them and discover something that they couldn't discover because they didn't have the flexibility or the love of truth that he did. And by him doing that, it not only had the effect of, it wasn't just like these stupid theories that they come up with today, like the God particle in standard model quantum mechanics, which changes nothing. Like, you know, we discovered the God particle in 2012 and it's like, what changed? Nothing. Oh, okay. So is that really a discovery or did we just explode two particles against each other, right? And then get like a few little orbital pathways that conform to some mathematical fudging of data that we put forth in the 60s saying that, oh, we got this thing that could account for the existence of mass and coherence. And, you know, we just like fudged the data and we made a new mathematical model, but it didn't change anything. So is that really a discovery? Or did we just, you know, play with a mathematical sleight of hand? And so with Ben Franklin, he demonstrated the true expression of a real discovery. Like when you create a real new solution concept, which we create by wrestling with tension of the mind with a paradox, right? Over a long time with unbroken concentration. That's what he did for years. He was obsessing in a healthy way. He was able to finally resolve the dissonance of the mind, he created his solution concept. And as an effect, he was able to invent something like 150 or more inventions, that like the lightning rod and other things that all allowed for our relationship to the universe to change in a way that allowed us to have a better quality of life, to sustain more people at a higher standard of living. So all of a sudden, and also more access to our mind powers, right? Which applied to the poor and the rich alike. And that's how he charmed. He was able to organize a big chunk of the European scientists, especially in France, where he was the ambassador. He was able to organize them to a different paradigm. These people who had been living in aristocracy and oligarchism in Europe, right? They were able, they had to confront the paradox that this uneducated guy from a non-hereditary superior bloodline was able to do something impossibly good. And that doing so caused a complete electric polarization in the minds in a good way, which allowed for a lot of the better European aristocrats and scientists to even support the American cause. Even some people in Britain were like, what are we doing? We're doing it all wrong. And they had to change their ways. And you had these fights within Britain as well over like, maybe we should, you know, you had actual lords of the parliament even saying, maybe we should just like let our colonies go. We've been doing this wrong, you know, because Ben Franklin was that good.
It's really so sweet and empowering to hear again and again that, you know, only a true discovery is when it improves people's quality of lives and people and inspire them more. And so And thank you for explaining that and emphasizing that in all your interviews. And by the way, Matt, feel free to share at any point in time. And all the rest also of here, Roy, Jane, and Matt, and Hartmut will you know feel free to just come in with any of your questions or comments, because I know Matt is under time pressure.
Oh, not that bad. We got time. It's good. But yeah,
are you actually going to do a presentation so we can actually look at the thing and then perhaps comment that?
Yeah, let's do that. So here, let me do a share. I'll do a share screen. Share screen. Windows. Here we are. Nope, wrong one. Uh-oh. Hold on. I'm so sorry. This worked out in our test run. Kind of wish I didn't do the test run, just did it now. Share screen.
Yeah, and while Matt is putting it up, just do yourself a favor and share it to others as well, okay? This podcast right now. Okay, I'm going to put it up.
Oh, yes. It was open there.
Yep. Can you guys see that?
Mm-hmm.
So this is the big point of confusion. I often say that, you know, we are... in a lot of my writings and interviews, you know, I always like this device of thinking about the battle over what the future will be centered around a clash of paradigms, and that those paradigms are differentiated by operating systems that are presumed to either be closed or open. It's not a done game. The old system that we have had as far as a neoliberal so-called rules-based, you know, order of globalization, unipolarism, especially that arose after 1992, that's pretty much over, and that's not coming back. It's not coming back, and it couldn't come back because it was always designed to fail. It was never designed to succeed. So since 1971, the thing that was put into motion that was the year that the U.S. dollar was floated onto the floating exchange rates. The process of liberalization, deregulation of the markets began to become more normalized, especially into the greed is good, you know, age of the 1980s of Thatcherism, Reaganomics, privatize everything. But it was also 1971, the time when the World Economic Forum was also created as a new sort of baby Bilderberger group, right, to organize for the solution of the oncoming demolition, the controlled demolition of the entire financial system. The financial system itself was turned into a time bomb of speculative banking, speculative debt, unpayable debts that are supporting fictitious capital that has grown at a hyperbolic rate, while the real economy that supports life, that supports the mind of people, has been allowed to atrophy for 50 plus years straight. R&D, investments into cutting edge research that we were doing in the 1960s, all of this was incrementally just destroyed by the early 80s, leaving only really the forms of technology that have been permitted during this time have been primarily information systems technologies have been permitted, entertainment, video game, you know, CGI, forms of technology that are tied to distraction, which is another form of, you know, mental enslavement if used for bad reasons or bad intentions. That technology, that form of creative growth has been permitted to grow in a controlled way. And also, you know, things like biotech, big pharma tech that involves really just creating billions and billions and trillions of dollars for private pharmaceutical companies rather than actually curing diseases, which was the purpose of health science to begin with. So we've now come to a point where we're going to get a new system. What will be its character? So we know that the closed system priesthood of the Davos clique of people like Klaus Schwab, his mentor, Henry Kissinger, that whole crew, they have what you could call a Malthusian religion that they want to bring about as a solution. It takes the form of things like Green New Deals, Build Back Better. Like, they use certain branding names, but overall the characteristic is to reduce the means, to use the crisis as an opportunity, the crisis that they themselves created, as an opportunity to introduce the solution, which involves going to forms of energy, food production practices, health technologies that will reduce the ability to support life on the Earth, both human and other. Now, that's not a coincidence. They thought it through, but they won't. They'll rarely, though they will sometimes say it the way that I just said it. So Yuval Harari has been a, I'll just say it quickly. I mean, he's an ideologue, so-called philosopher. He calls himself a scientist of what, I don't know, who has been really trotted up and promoted to become like the spokesman for the new philosophy, the new paradigm that the Davos crew wants to bring online. Harari says two quotes, and there's two quotes here I'm going to cite that gets across this. Describing the useless eater phenomenon, he says, I think that the biggest question in maybe in economics and politics in the coming decades will be what to do with all these useless people. The problem is more boredom and what to do with them and how will they find some sense of meaning in life when they are basically meaningless, worthless. My best guess at present is a combination of drugs and computer games as a solution for most. It's already happening. I think once you're superfluous, you don't have power. So Harari, I mean, he's describing what his idea of technology is, which is very different from the Ben Franklin human experience of technological and scientific progress, which is that in his mind, technology always makes human beings more and more irrelevant in time. Because his view is that automation, information systems, everything else will take over the functions of the human machines, which is all he defines. And people like him, they always think of human beings as simply mechanical devices, eating and pooping machines, which have emotions and want to have sex. Like that's really the essence of what makes human human. Of course, when he speaks about these worthless people who are going to be made worthless by machines replacing their activity in the fourth industrial revolution, he rarely refers to his own self. He always refers to them as them, which is a symptom of people who have God complexes. It's a bit of a sickness. So their lives are going to be meaningless, worthless, and they won't have any power anymore. In the new age that's coming on, human beings, as we've known them for thousands of years, have been able to utilize political power because they had labor that they could give or remove from service of the master class in order to give themselves power, says Harari. But now that the vast majority are going to be replaced, and we can give them, you know, obviously some drugs and video games to satisfy their lusts while they wait to be euthanized or something, they won't have political power because they won't have labor to offer or to withhold. And then he calls for a new religion. Just to make it clear, he sees himself as like this new technocratic transhuman Moses. And he's what's called a transhumanist, where he says, we have no answer in the Bible and also the Quran and Torah and other things. We have no answer what to do with humans who are no longer useful to the economy. You need completely new ideologies, completely new religions, and they are likely to emerge from Silicon Valley and not from the Middle East. And they are likely going to give people visions based on technology. I think he's referring to probably drugs and metaverse, you know, that give you visions. Everything that the old religions promised, happiness and justice and even eternal life, but here on Earth with the help of technology and not after death with the help of some supernatural being. I find that pathetic and hilarious. But you sort of get a sense of the insecurity of those who are promoting and who believe in this ideology, which is ultimately they've been unable to reconcile the very obvious fundamental problem, not even problem, but reality of the human condition, which is that we are self-aware of our mortality. We have access to these ideas of truth, of eternity, of beauty, of goodness in a hot perfection. We have concepts like that, but we live in a world that is imperfect, not eternal in the sense that our bodies and, you know, are limited, right? So they can't resolve their fear of death. And they're all obsessed with getting the Philosopher's Stone or, you know, El Dorado or drinking from the chalice of the Holy Grail or whatever else, you know, like to try to give themselves, these are the mythologies of the oligarchy for the past centuries and millennia. The new variants that have been created involve things like uploading your binary computer program into the cloud, aka, because they don't believe in soul, they don't believe in freedom, they don't believe in God. These are all metaphysical abstractions that have no meaning for a materialist, but yet they still have to transplant their idea of heaven with clouds that you upload, but they're clouds that are run by Google or Microsoft, right? Or transplanting your body into a cyborg, or infusing technology into you in such a way that we can stay relevant, in so that computers don't replace us with AI too soon. They still believe it's inevitable that AI is going to completely replace biological forms of life in time. But they're like, well, like Elon Musk, right? Neuronet. We can slow down that replacement age where we go extinct by increasingly becoming hybrids with machines, you know, emerging, creating test tube babies a la Aldous Huxley with CRISPR tech increasingly, or just infusing with different forms of machinery. So all these transhumanists, they all have this élan vital mystical idea that we are being propelled forward by this increasing system of complexity, which is reaching a bifurcation point around which some new age is going to just emerge. So it's a very mystical idea. And this new age is where essentially machines take over life. And they always position themselves as still existing within that new system as the overlord masters, the new gods, right, of this new religion. And even when you look at things like the Great Narrative Project of the World Economic Forum, that's actually a project, is to create new religions for that are relevant for the post-Great Reset age.
And this, the one world religion that's kind of being formed at the moment, I believe, is in Dubai, where they're actually building it. I don't know, is it built? But like, from my understanding, is that all the religions are on board for this. Like, are the public aware of this?
Well, you have kind of like, I wrote in my book, The Clash of the Two Americas, to get across the two different opposing traditions within the USA, going back to the 1750s to the present. You have sort of the same thing in religions, where you have oligarchical and humanist battles within Islam, within Judaism, within Christianity, within Hinduism, everything. You have these battles of those who see human beings as being made in the image of mud to be controlled by a master class, and you have agents within, you know, each that have penetrated fifth columns into every religious group. And then you have people who actually abide by the principles that are expressed for the good in their various religious texts. That assert in various forms and various words and languages that human beings are made good in the image of a creator, can participate in the process of creation, right? That our conscience, that there will be effects for our lives having been lived good or bad in this life, that will have some repercussion in some form after we die. So you got good people and bad people in all, but indeed, you know, when you look at the Vatican, for example, I think it really fell under a coup d'etat to this Jesuit transhumanist type of ideology. Does that mean every single church and within the Catholic Church is corrupt, or that every single bishop and cardinal is all in on board on it? Not at all. There's fights. We see examples of many good people fighting within. Same thing for Islamic mosques and other things. But yeah, they want to create a new religion. A new synthetic religion controlled by a new, you know, high priesthood. And they want that high priesthood to have their own synthetic religion of the elite that's controlled by a still higher high priesthood. So it's a, you know, it's a system of illusion and nested illusions. It's not a system that has any regard to the idea that we all can discover truth by awakening our inner potential, right? To to do what Ben Franklin did again. And people like Plato and others, I mean, throughout history, you've got examples of people who were able to discover truths, great and small, share and participate in those truths with the universe and have the universe resonate to our new knowledge of creation by giving us a greater power of action to have a better life, more people, better quality of life, more space, you know. So these guys don't believe that. They think technology is just to enslave us. They don't see technology as a liberating force, which is really what it is. It's more of a spiritual thing, if you think about it. It's like the technology from a proper standpoint is the effect of our interface with the divine by being creative, and we can then find ways of expressing that creativity in material ways that allows us to have certain material effects, but it should never be seen as caused by materialism, which is what these guys do.
Just on the technology there with the, like, is what I'm seeing is with the children, they're really bringing them in at an early age now with Minecraft, and like everything is tracked. So they're learning everything from them. So they know how to condition them later. The whole lot is actually systemized without people even realizing it. And unfortunately, parents, they're happy. Their child is sitting down with, you know, without disturbing them. But it's shocking the amount of, you know, the millions that are involved in that, young children watching, you know, the likes of Minecraft with everything being tracked.
Well, yeah, I mean, and in a sense, these kids are have been targeted. They're being changed according to an idea that they are like software, that the video game programmers of their lives are able to modify their wiring of their brain in order to get them addicted and to think of certain norms that were, you know, involve metaverse, getting into, you know, augmented reality, virtual reality, things like that. Modes of value systems that have no bearing on how the universe actually works, that you know, get them to think that their emotions are the source of the foundation upon which they should build their ideas of what is true or false, right? And if you feel like, you know, you're born a boy but you feel like a girl, well, you must be a girl. And if you feel like a banana, you must be a banana, because that's how you genuinely feel. And it's like the whole idea that there was such a thing as even like male or female has become something that is akin to almost like, well, you must be a fascist if you think that. And it's like, well, like, what if you, math, even people have been making the argument over the last, you know, of that math itself is intrinsically racist, rather than the idea that it was used by racists, which is the proper argument. There is now a whole hype school of thought which has contaminated our school system, which teaches kids that no, math itself is intrinsically racist, because because slave masters used math to measure how many slaves they could fit on a galley. So you know, you have a creation of mediocrity in the target population, and the millennials, the young people born after the year 2000 especially, have really gotten it bad. Obviously, there's wonderful phenomena of things like I was mentioning, my young friend Declan and his family, who have demonstrated how through a proper, loving, non-uber-liberal family unit, they were able to break free of that, and they read Shakespeare together. They, you know, he was telling me that they're even reading my book series every night, a chapter together as a family unit, and discussing this as their entertainment, right? That's just phenomenal with other families, right? That are working together. So you can definitely awaken something much more human. And it's in a sense a lot easier, because to create human beings that are so unnaturally misshapen, like the majority of the kids are being processed right now to become really misshapen souls, who will much more quickly adapt to an artificial fascist technotronic system of governments. That takes a lot of work. It's like a bonsai tree, right? Like a bonsai tree is not supposed to grow that way. That takes a lot of work to artificially like warp the growth of the bonsai tree with, like, you know, steel wires over time and there's there's a certain prettiness about them, but that's a lot of work. To just let a tree grow naturally is much easier. You pour water on it, give it sunlight, give it some nutrients. You know, in a sense, it's much more natural, what I'm trying to say, to grow a healthy, well-rounded human being than it is to grow one of these, you know, Greta Thunberg types. So anyway, useless eaters. So, and that's really how to create useless eaters, right? You create people who are not able to tap into their own powers of creative thought properly, so that they can't refute why they're overpopulated. And when the time comes to where they have to make, you know, they're confronted with the argument that, well, there's not enough resources to go around to support your mom or your dad or maybe even yourself in, you know, when you're 50, 60 years old.
Just on that, actually, because a lot of the times, you know, we're told overpopulated, but if you look at Africa, like, we were lied to the whole time about the size of Africa on the maps.
Yeah.
Africa. You know, and most people don't even realize that.
No, yeah, you could fit. I mean, I saw studies with the 8 billion people we have now. You could give each person a townhouse with a little plot of land. Every person on the earth in Texas, the state of Texas, every person, just to get, you would never want to organize a society that way, admittedly. But I'm just saying, you could fit every person, all 8 billion, into a townhouse, a little plot of land in Texas. And that's 8 billion people. So it's like, proportionally, who's saying that we're overpopulated? You know, anyway, but it's not even a question of space. It's more a question of like quality of minds that can use and create. Like, why can't we green a desert? You know, like you can desalinate water. You can green a desert. The deserts today used to be green. Not that, you know, a few thousand years ago, the Sahara blossomed. So why can't we just do that again? Because we're told we're not allowed. It's like, well, okay, who's telling us that? It's the Malthusians. The people who are trying to create scarcity so that we get into our little cage. So who is this Malthus? They call themselves Malthusians. Yuval Harari is a Malthusian. Thomas Malthus was himself also literally a priest. He was I think he was a Calvinist, but I'm not sure. A reverend. But he was really satanic. He was more of the Hellfire Club style Christian priest. And he was a employee for the British Empire. He was a teacher at the British East India Company's Haileybury College, which was the key college that produced all of the economists, the managers, the civil servants that would like manage the colonial office and the British Empire for a long time. So he was a key controller, a grand strategist in that sense. And he put out a mathematical way of controlling society. And I'll show it to you. But he basically says, in terms of the problem of population growth, he says we being, you know, the more than humans, the Ubermenschen, the managers of the British Empire, we should facilitate instead of foolishly and vainly endeavoring to impede the operations of nature in producing this mortality. And if we dread the too frequent visitation of the horrid form of famine, we should sedulously encourage the other forms of destruction, which we compel nature to use. In our towns, we should make the streets narrower, crowd more people into the houses, and court the return of the plague. So this is something which he's not a theoretician. He's actually describing things that are put into practice. All of these things are done over the ensuing 250 years since it was written in 1799. And he goes on. I should propose a regulation to be made declaring that no child born from any marriage taking place after the expiration of a year from the date of the law and no illegitimate child born 2 years from the same date should ever be entitled to parish assistance. The infant is, comparatively speaking, of little value to society, as others will immediately supply its place. That cold son of a bitch. So just to get across, right? Like this is kind of like the way people think in terms of the quality adjusted life year model of the National Institute of Clinical Excellence of Britain that has put on online this mathematical idea of how do you judge lives that are more or less worthy to be lived? Who will receive the scarce medical resources in a constrained medical system? Well, they say, well, let's create quality adjusted life years. So in their logic, and people like, you know, Ezekiel Emanuel is a big promoter of this. This is at the heart of the Obama healthcare reforms that have been revived in today's Biden USA. Which essentially calls for placing a dollar value on the average year of life of people based upon their age. And so in the mind of somebody like this, they have said and argued that a child might only be meritorious, like a child of 2 years, 3 years of age or younger has less value dollar-wise per year than somebody who is 22, who has already been the system has invested in their education and they're a worker who will pay this amount of money for taxes for the next 45 years. They have a higher yearly value for one year of life than the infant does, which will not receive medical treatment under conditions of scarcity. Same thing for an older person. Your value decreases as you get older, despite the fact that your power of wisdom should also increase, and thus your power of making society better should also increase as you get older, but they ignore that because they're materialists. So this is Malthus. He's saying we should let infants die if needed because they have little value and others will take their place in a very utilitarian worldview as of a system. And we should court what nature gave us to regulate populations of famine, plague, war, you know, the four horsemen. Those are all good things, and this is what made British economy, it became known as the dismal science, because it was no longer the science of happiness of Ben Franklin, because Ben Franklin taught that economics was the science of happiness, that the science of government, which was understood as a type of technology. Government, the crafting of laws, the crafting of constitutions is a form of metaphysical technology, but that is not deterministic in Ben Franklin's understanding or in the understanding of Abraham Lincoln or John F. Kennedy, who we'll look at. But it was rather a system that was influenced by wisdom and free will or folly. It could be made better or worse according to design, purpose, and intention, both of the framers of the laws, but also of each individual generation that either renewed that understanding or let it dissipate. And if those laws of a society should ever become too crystallized, incapable of self-perfectibility, of change, for a directed change, then that society loses its mandate, its ability to sustain its own freedom. You know, and that's the Ben Franklin idea of what did you create for us when he was asked, a republic if you can keep it. That's the whole idea. So it's contingent on each individual generation renewing and defending and improving upon what was created to make a republic work. And that requires a culture which is more than mediocre. You cannot allow for mediocrity in culture to overtake your system. Otherwise, we give up liberties in order to achieve stability or security, at which point, as Ben Franklin also said, we lose the right for both. So that's Thomas Malthus, who Ben Franklin also refuted in his essays on the increase of mankind in 1751. And this is what his prodigy Alexander Hamilton also took aim at in his many writings, which is also why Alexander Hamilton has become so demonized by years and years of propaganda to convince us that he was a Rothschild stooge out to destroy the USA. And in fact, no, he was an anti-Malthusian hero who saved the USA and allowed the US to survive its first precarious 40 years of existence after the revolution, and created the basis upon which every great president who is shot and dies or is poisoned and dies while in office is invoking, all the way from Harrison in 1840 to Lincoln, to Garfield, to McKinley, to FDR and JFK. They're all invoking the exact same Ben Franklin Hamiltonian anti-Malthusian principle. And we'll see more of that. This is the great mathematical discovery for social engineers that Malthus created, where he was able to identify that human populations always grow geometrically in blue, and food resources replenish themselves arithmetically in red, giving way to a crisis point at which means that the social engineers, the mathematicians, the economists managing the system from above always have a tool to regulate the blue curve long before it ever supersedes the red curve with the remedies he proposed. The transhumanists are a direct outgrowth of this. Charles Darwin. Okay, so we're all taught Charles Darwin discovered the law of evolution, of the survival of the fittest in a race for diminishing returns. Okay, well, did he really, or is this just a theory that was promoted for political objectives at the expense of better theories that could more properly describe the reason flow of evolution as it is actually observed in fossil records? My contention is, and I think the evidence speaks to this, that it was more of a political ideology than it is a scientific ideology. Charles Darwin is also a mathematician, a biologist who thought of biology in a mathematical way, just like Malthus thought of human systems in a mathematical way. And, he writes his autobiography, I think in the 1870s, I believe, describing how he came to his discovery of his theory of evolution. And he describes here in October 1838, 15 months after I had begun my systematic inquiry, I happened to read for amusement Malthus on population, and being prepared to appreciate the struggle for existence, which everywhere goes on, from long-continued observation of the habits of animals and plants, it at once struck me that under these circumstances, favorable variations would tend to be preserved, and unfavorable ones to be destroyed. The result would be the formation of a new species. And here, then, I had at last got a theory by which to work. What did he just say? Did he just say he got his discovery, his theory of evolution, from reading Thomas Malthus? Yes, he did. He did say that. So he's basically, you know, what is the Darwin theory? It tries to account for the newly discovered evidence of fossil records, indicating that species are not as immutable as we had hitherto thought they were, and that instead you tend to have these new types of species coming into being over time. And the question was, is there a direction to it? Is there a purpose? Is there a design? Is there evidence of an intention behind this entire flow? If so, what are its rules? Is there a harmony of the parts within organisms? What about organisms as they relate to their species or their system as a whole? And so a lot of scientists, just like scientists in Ben Franklin's day, were all trying to fixate on what's the nature of this electrical force. This is like an obsession throughout the 19th century, is what is the mechanism? Darwin, in his view, the mechanism is that there's a fight for diminishing returns in a closed set of resources that are always going to diminish as the parts that eat, that have sex within them, grow and multiply. So as you get that multiplication, you get a tension. As you get the tension, you have now an impetus for what's called a randomized mutation function to happen. So there's a constant, imagine a rolling of the dice, metaphorically, always happening within the organism that cause random changes. And sometimes you get lucky and you get, you know, 8 sixes a million times in a row. And all of a sudden a variant will arise, a mutation that allows for a bigger claw or a bigger fang or a longer tongue for an anteater or something, right? That will then allow it to edge out its competitors, to eat more ants, to run faster, kill better, have more sex, spread its seed, and thus the old mutations will disappear and the new mutations will follow, and new species come into being gradually. Now, the problem here is that there is no evidence of gradualism in the fossil records. You tend to get these leaps, these discontinuous sort of quantum leaps in time. You never tend to get just a gradualism, like, you know, 1,000 different variants of monkey slowly making its way to humans. You tend to get, you know, very specific quantum leaps, in a sense, you know, throughout that process. You get that for all sorts of species. So that was a problem. How do we account for the absence of gradualistic evidence? And also, well, what about the evidence that there is a non-randomness in the universe? Because, I mean, if it's true that we moved, that life, living matter, moved from being simple-celled organisms, some time ago, to being increasingly interesting, to the point that we're all now having a conversation mediated through electrical currents, throughout space and time, using processes of the mind, of this complex brain, you know, interfacing with my body, inducing sounds that are intelligible, right, to you guys and to the audience. Like, if all of that was random, well, I got a bridge to sell you. I mean, it's like somebody, you know, you hear the example of, like, well, it's like having somebody with all of the ingredients for making a cake that they bought at the grocery store. They fall down the stairs, and when they get to the bottom of the stairs, you have a cake. It's like, no, there's obviously evidence of intelligent design, of intent in everything we look at, even from galaxy formation. You know, the golden section occurs not just in the formation of living matter, but also occurs in galaxies, implying that there might be something that is more than dead animating, or, you know, even the formation of galaxies and the birth of stars within galaxies and the birth of galaxies from galaxies, right? Like, there's a whole way of thinking about science that Benjamin Franklin was fighting to defend that has been derailed. So Charles Darwin was a Malthusian. He just took Malthus and applied Malthus to all of life, whereas Malthus was applying his theories to human life.
And Matthew, you mentioned a satanic.
Sure.
Yeah, and, like, there seems to be an agenda to cut us off from our connection to source and our brilliance and genius. I don't understand Satanism very much at all. Is like, what is the underlying belief there?
I think that the universal constant, because there's different manifestations of this thing, you know. But overall, the constancy that I think is there is the tendency to see to detach the self from the species and from the universe and from God, and to see yourself instead as an arrogant elite who believes that you yourself are God, that through the sheer force of will you can make the universe conform to your desires of how you would like the universe and its creation to be, rather than to adapt yourself to the discoveries that you could have made about how that universe actually is, and that should tell us something about the creator of said laws, right? If there's laws, there's a lawmaker, and if the laws are there, we didn't make them. It means that there's something that flows as far as the essence of the creator through the discoverable laws that also should tell us about what we are actually, you know. But as we go outward and discover the universe, we find out what we are inside, and they don't want to do that. And I think that you have those who don't want to do that, and they're foolish. They didn't know better. And I wouldn't say that those who I think are the majority of people who are instruments for the will of the oligarchy tend to fall into that gray zone category. They're not fully aware of what they are doing. They're instruments for the will of a higher power. For those who are aware that they're destroying a higher truthful good, but are unwilling to change their way of thinking because they love their hedonistic pleasures and their, you know, more than truth, they will destroy the good and I think that qualifies you as evil. And any type of rituals that go on as far as the creation of perverse, you know, there's like a weird spiritualism embedded in a lot of this that involves awakening passions that are the most unnatural as possible. And we've all seen evidence of that, right? And certain mythologies are created and passed down from one generation of oligarch to the next. But I think that they need to hide behind certain nested sets of theories, both for the masses and also for their own managers because they will always need managers, civil, you know, high upper echelon groupings to manage the complex system.
Yeah.
Who are not allowed themselves to know what's really going on. They're like in Plato's cave, right? Plato's allegory of the cave. Yeah. Those who are given the special, the higher education to manage the puppets that cast the shadows on the cave wall are themselves not necessarily the puppet masters. They believe in their own sets of puppets too.
And it makes me question if it doesn't come from a species that doesn't have connection to source. Therefore they have to control those of us that do. But
I approach it epistemologically myself. Like I tend to look at epistemological battles and how they relate to the soul and our interface with God. Let's keep that discussion actually because there's a few more points to zero in on. Since we are dealing with something that is using Satan or satanic theories masquerading in a secular modality. So Darwin himself was never capable of arguing or defending his own position in public, implying to me that he was probably more of a tool. And I don't think he was self-aware of how his theories were being used politically. And I get that sense because he describes in later years in letters to his mother how he is... he lost the ability to find joy in poetry and music in Shakespeare like he did when he was a kid. And he said, when I was a younger man, I used to even write poetry. And I feel that my own theories have destroyed my ability to love beauty. And he describes this in a really agonizing way in a letter to his mom. And it's sad. So I see Darwin as sort of a useful idiot who sort of, you know, like the mafia says, you don't do your own drugs, right? They're there to be sold. And some of these oligarchs end up, you know, consuming their own the poison that was supposed to be reserved for their victims. Who were a little bit more in controlling positions, though? And I think here it's useful to look at the person of Thomas Huxley, who is the founder of the term agnosticism. And Huxley created in 1865 a network called the X Club, run out of the Royal Society, which sort of brought together different representatives in Britain of British empiricism, who had become dominant in their fields of mathematics, astronomy, sociology, economics. The guy down here is Herbert Spencer, the guy with the funny half beard sideburns, who was a frequent guest at these X Club meetings. It was sort of like an early think tank to try to take control of all different branches of science under this Darwinian interpretation of a closed system of pure description in mathematics, ignoring the qualitative reality that should be the thing that a true scientist is always concerned about, not does the universe fit your mathematical formula. And he's the guy who created social Darwinism, the first application of Darwin's theory into weeding out the unfit, sort of a neo-Malthusianism. Galton later on comes out of this process too. And Thomas Huxley has a whole network of students, including H.G. Wells, who go on to be high-level predictive programming black magicians, in a sense, and many others who even create things like the emergent evolution doctrine, the neo-Darwinianism of emergent evolution, which is attractive to a lot of spiritual people, but in reality, it's actually just a trap, which, you know, people like his grandson, Julian Huxley, was a big promoter of it. And Julian Huxley took the emergent evolutionary idea that there are these independent of our free will or thoughts. There is this force, this élan vital, like I said, a vitalism of just this evolutionary force compelling us demonically towards a point of increasing complexity where human beings will effectively, you know, they say we'll achieve Christ consciousness, says transhumanist Pierre-Teilhard de Chardin, who works with Julian Huxley. But in reality, they just mean total enslavement under a technocratic feudalism. That's what they mean. But they'll say other things that sound attractive, often to even Christians and religious people. So anyway, the X Club is an attempt to try to codify and out of this emerges things like eugenics under Francis Galton, Darwin's cousin, who Darwin says, "You won me over. I didn't want to believe that your theories were right, but you've totally won me over," which is, again, a more hands-on version of social Darwinism. Social Darwinism of Spencer was just, it was like more of like an Adam Smith free market idea of liberalism to weed out the unfit. That if you just let all governments just have no influence over the economy, let everybody just be a hedonistic beast, the weak will be weeded out, will be killed, the strong will dominate, and an eventual new species of Ubermenschen, better, more than humans, will just emerge that way. Galton, this is a fake debate, right? Because Galton, his so-called debate opponent, said, no, we can't let chaos dominate that process. We have to make it more of a hands-on science. There's rules, you see, of statistically determining who will be less smart in the future, who will be more prone to criminal behavior by looking at your grandparents and great grandparents and forecasting where your child's or grandkids' proficiencies will be or will not be. And based upon such statistical probability, we will justify sterilizing you now. That was eugenics or breeding positive
one
eugenics.
Question.
Right.
Huh? One question I have.
Yeah.
So these guys, the Huxley Club, is, let's say, the basis of the high school system.
Yes. Yeah, today's high school system is totally influenced by all of these figures. John Tyndale's method, Dalton Hooker, Matthew Arnold. Yeah. Yeah, it's all mathematics. An idea that science is description, not discovery. It's voyeuristic. That's what even Stephen Hawking said. His view of science is to describe everything. And it's like, no, it's to discover. It's to discover, not to describe. You're thinking like a voyeur.
And it's so interesting because Rockefeller wrote a book in the beginning of the 20th century about the change or transformation of the school system, and where the people started not to think in artists or philosophy and all that stuff, but they are only focused on agriculture and medicine, a new medicine, and they become really the slave. So they are really this, the slaves for the work. That's it. Yeah. And this is the whole school system today.
That's brilliant what you just said. Yeah. And that ties into the useless eater thing, because it's like, how are they able to create people who are less than human? Is you cut them off from their source. You cut them off. You teach them the techniques to make them like cogs in a machine, but you don't teach them the spiritual, the artistic, the aesthetic side, of themselves. You cut that off and you say, no, the arts are the world of feeling, and science is the world of logic. And by making that artificial divide that they cannot coexist, people lose their creative powers to be more than the machine. They cannot be more than the repetitive action that they were expected to do in the system that they were, born into. And then when the system is overridden by something more, they cannot adapt to that new system, and then they become obsolete. And then they either go into criminal activity or you sterilize them or whatever, right? So it's, that's the creation, the Rockefeller reforms in education. Yeah, we're designed to do that rather than to have people who are both mechanics, but also creative and could be artists too, right? Could play an instrument, which is why a lot of the greatest scientists of Germany, were also musicians. And a lot why was Max Planck a great scientific discoverer who opened up the door to the quantum world? It's because he was also a professional musician. He almost, went into, he's a pianist, and he would often perform with Albert Einstein, who was a violinist. They would perform Mozart and Beethoven together when they were having a creative block in their formulas. They would go get nonlinear, get beautiful by tapping into the source of Mozart, and then revisit their formulas with a fresh spirit, and discovery concepts would arise in a beautiful way. And they talked about that, and it was much more understood. It was not so mystified as it is today.
And the interesting thing is, for example, Wolfgang Goethe, the poet, he knew 90,000 words, and the average German today knows 12,000 words. Mm. This is very interesting because it's a very decreasing. And if we talk about, I have one comment about Satanism. The interesting thing about Satanism is that they have the belief system that they will incarnate in the same family, and they use the rituals in order to get in the right family again by birth. So the interesting thing about the Satanists is they think about generations.
Yes.
And they think they will be reborn on this planet again. So for them, only this planet exists and nothing else.
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a good point. I think there's maybe a little bit of debate within the oligarchy about they have their own debates on whether they have to reincarnate into machines or something like that, or upload into some literal cloud of like a Google cloud or something to avoid entropy and death. But I think you're right. They got a whole set of rituals to try to control the consequence of their whatever they think of as their souls beyond their death, despite the fact that they have made immoral, continuous decisions at every moment in the course of their lives, right? They don't want to think about the consequence of living an evil-driven life willfully. They could have lived a better life, but they didn't. Instead, they want to try to induce certain formulas and spells and rituals to try to control what happens to them after death. And it's like, no, it's not how that works. There's no evidence that things work that way.
What very important is that we also have to understand is that this situation in which we are right now is more than 150 years or more than 200 years old. Because first of all, the You can see it in the movie Metropolis. I don't know whether you know this movie. And also, for example, the leader of the IG Farben company, Fritz Temer, who was responsible for the spell Works May Free. Yeah. He was only 7 years in prison. Then he became in the Council of Bayer, and he was the one who was responsible for the Codex Alimentarius in 1969, which explains the use of genetic modified organisms, which became activated in 2009. So they think in many lifetimes, and they think in many centuries. The situation is, as you said, what is your vision of how do you think what will the future look like with all your knowledge? Because you see, let's say on the one hand, you see the power of the people, how they try it. You see the awakening of other people, and you see also the demoralization and, let's say, the mass hypnosis of the masses. And do you have any feeling how a future can look like?
Depends if people take the time to use their minds or not. Because, I mean, I think the biggest problem we have is not in numbers. That, like, those who don't want to live in a dystopic future of a world government, a satanic priest class, it's not like there's too few of us. It's that they're too mediocre. They've been led to believe that the culture that they were born into is normal, and that they have put very little effort into utilizing their mental muscles properly to properly develop a sense of what is their mind in a healthy, natural process. And they're mentally lazy oftentimes, which caused them to make bad judgments and become increasingly manipulated by forces that ultimately want to kill them. And they know it, but they don't know how to actually, you got to think the enemy is not mentally unrigorous. They're not lazy. They're very rigorous. They know history. They took the time to train their progeny to be very smart in some ways, although very stupid in other ways. But you have to not only think at least on that level, but even higher if you're going to beat them. Like, this is again why I always say Benjamin Franklin. Like, the guy was a great exemplar of somebody who was so rigorous and so honest and used his time so well that he was able to supersede the dominant theories of his age and create a new paradigm that had never existed before that gave us this opportunity to have our conversations today. That's the reason why the empire has not won for the past. They wanted to have a global feudal slave plantation 300 years ago. It's not like this is a new desire, but you have this other thing that awakens that Ben Franklin tapped into, that I think is being tapped into. The reason why they haven't won today is because you have a certain awakening happening in the Western part of the world. But the only place where I actually see proper statecraft being utilized to do battle with this thing is in Eurasia. It's not here. So people here have to recognize that, you know, Eurasia is not their enemy, which is what a lot of people think. They just think that, you know, China, Russia are the evil bad guys behind Davos, and they don't know any of this history. They haven't taken the time to research the battle in science. They just don't know, or they have, you know. So, I mean, I could say a few more words. I have about five more slides. I kind of answer your question. In the
yes, course. Please.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. Go ahead.
The closed system idea, though, just so you know, one of the key ideas is that, again, justified the more updated Malthusianism of the 20th century. It took the form of something called the second law of thermodynamics, which today permeates everything from ecological sciences to economics to even galaxy cosmology. It influences everything. This idea that all systems are fundamentally closed, that all that exists now as far as energy is all that ever could exist to sustain the system in question, like an engine. When you put oil in your gas tank, over time you're burning the oil, the parts of the engine move, but they're always moving with less potential to the point of a heat death, right? And that is a deterministic process. It gives you a sense of directionality. These Neo-Darwinians, Malthusians, eugenicists, they all adhere to the church of entropy, that that's the only fundamental single law of the universe. Everything else is ultimately random, but this is not random. And if we're made in the image of that universe, then, you know, we are also entropic. And thus, it requires an alpha class, right, a superior class to manage the diminishing returns. As a quick example of somebody who didn't think this way, a follower of Alexander von Humboldt, who was a friend of Goethe, who also refuted Newton on optics and color, is interesting. Goethe actually was a scientist who refuted Newton and the Newtonian theory of color, which I love. Is Karl-Ernst von Baer, who was also an artist and a scientist. And in 1876, he developed a more healthy theory of evolution, saying the reciprocal interconnection of organisms with one another and their relationship to the universal materials that offer them the means for sustaining life is what has been called the harmony of nature. That is a relationship of mutual regulation. Just as tones, musical tones, only give rise to a harmony when they are bound together in accordance with certain rules, so can the individual processes in the wholeness of nature only exist and endure if they stand in certain relationships to one another. Chance, that is randomness, is unable to create anything enduring. Rather, it is only capable of destruction. Karl-Ernst von Baer, underappreciated, wonderful scientist mind, and also political. He was a political philosopher too. One of his colleagues in America, Abraham Lincoln's leading economic advisor, Henry C. Carey, wrote a book called The Unity of Law and the Unification of Moral Technological Sciences. And this guy was the most influential economist, both with networks in Germany, around Otto von Bismarck, around the Friedrich List Society, as well as in Russia, Japan, China, South America. Like, he was everywhere. And he is not taught in schools anymore. They don't publish his books anymore. They only publish Adam Smith and those who are in conformity with, Satanism. But Henry C. Carey wrote in 1872, directly against Malthus and also Darwin in this book, he says, of all the contrivances for crushing out all Christian feeling and for developing self-worship that the world yet has seen, there has been none entitled to claim so high a rank as that which has been and daily is assigned to the Malthusian law of population. And then he says more positively, so it's this self-worship egotism that anybody who's an adherent to the Malthus theory of population, they will suffer from. Then he says on a positive level, well, what is the source of what should be shaping our idea of value, economic behavior, money? He says the more perfect that power of self-direction, the greater is the tendency towards increased control of mind over matter, the wretched slave to nature gradually yielding place to the master of nature, in whom the feeling of responsibility to his family, his country, his creator, and himself grows with the growth of power to guide and direct the vast and various forces placed at his command. So it's a very different, more optimistic idea of science and technology that, you know, he gives the example, when we're ignorant to the forces of wind currents, you don't have the freedom to sail out to sea as much, right? When you discover the nature of wind, you can create sails all of a sudden. Wind becomes a servant. You no longer have to have galley slaves rowing your boat for you because now you can use the force of nature to be the servant of your needs. Same thing with a machine that can do the work of 1,000 slaves. The slaves are then free to be human. They don't have to live 14-hour-a-day manual labor lives. They now can explore their artistic, scientific selves and be contributors to the real value of the upshift of humankind. So in Henry C. Carey's view, to deal with useless eaters is you make them useful creators. And he says so explicitly in all of his works. And this is Abraham Lincoln's key economic advisor. Useless eaters is an arrogant, elitist label. Useful creators is our true destiny and our true nature. John F. Kennedy took aim at this when he was organizing on a multitude of levels, where he says Malthus at the National Academy of Sciences, 1963, October 22nd, 1 month before he's assassinated. He says, Malthus argued a century and a half ago that man, by using up all his available resources, would forever press on the limits of subsistence, thus condemning humanity to an infinite future of misery and poverty. we can now begin to hope, and I believe know, that Malthus was expressing not a law of nature, but merely the limitation then of scientific and social wisdom. I think this is beautiful because people don't appreciate Kennedy as a epistemological, as a cultural warrior the way he was. But he wasn't just calling for the end, the extraction of U.S. troops from Vietnam, the ending of the Vietnam War. He wasn't just doing that. He was also openly calling for breaking the Cold War system of controls by having an alliance with Russia around a space program that would be jointly controlled by both Russian and American forces together so that we could find more points of harmony and mutual interest in co-explorers of the universe. And he has let speeches where he talks about not just the idea of going to the moon or something. He actually talks frequently about stretching human activity to the edges of the solar system and beyond. He is thinking about hitching our destiny to the infinite of creation, which completely changes how we see ourselves as a species of hedonism, of right pursuing pleasure and avoiding pain, to being a species that pursues the love of wisdom and the love of discovery, which involves tapping into the small universe of atomic behavior, which has so many secrets still that we have to discover, that allows for the transference of energy into matter and matter into energy at the service of the needs of both human systems as well as the systems of the ecosystem itself. You know, like asteroids are going to hit. Asteroids periodically hit the Earth. Comets do as well. Very, very destructive to all life. Living systems don't appreciate that. They suffer a lot. So human beings seem to be the first species that has exhibited the characteristic where we could feasibly break an extinction cycle. No other species has exhibited those potentialities up until this point. But the question then becomes, are we tolerant of the system of Satanism, of empire, that allows us to destroy all of this potential to break an extinction cycle? You know, we got ice ages. The sun is doing strange things right now that imply that we are probably going into either a small or a long ice age, which is going to be doing great damage to living systems, including food systems, even more than the damage we are doing to it ourselves, which we are doing it to ourselves right now. So my last slide, just to get across the battle over the paradigms of what will be the nature of the fourth industrial revolution, which is just, this is an old idea that goes back to the 1950s, that we are with information technology, machine learning processes, human labor that is repetitive is not going to be needed. So the question is, what type of social organization is going to come about? And is it going to be based upon a new technotronic feudalism of global enslavement and mass depopulation? And is that going to be what technology does in terms of, you know, machine learning could do a lot of good for a variety of things in medicine, as well as in, mining, especially going into other planets or asteroids. You don't want to put human beings into space for a very long time. There's all sorts of things that could hurt and kill humans. But so you'd want it to be automated for a long period, but that means that it would be nice to have logarithms that could, you know, learn in a certain way when new stimulation is encountered that allows it to not just break down on the first thing that happens when you're in space that a programmer did not anticipate. Computer 3D printing, things like that. This is revolutionary stuff, but is it going to be used again to enslave or to liberate us? Is it going to be a servant or a master? Or a master tool, that's the question. Putin's speech should be read in full at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum. It's a fantastic speech where he basically calls for the end of the unipolar age and a calling forth of the defense of the sovereign nation state, multipolarism, cooperation instead of competition. Very, very strong speech. Anyway, I picked a little selection where it deals with technology. But he says, and then I'm going to end, technological development is a cross-cutting area that will define the current decade and the entire 21st century. We will review in depth our approaches to building a groundbreaking technology-based economy, a techno-economy, at the upcoming Strategic Development Council meeting. There is so much we can discuss. Most importantly, many managerial decisions must be made in the sphere of engineering, education, and transferring research to the real economy. And the provision of financial resources for fast-growing high-tech companies. Changes in the global economy, finances, and international relations are unfolding at an ever faster, ever-growing pace and scale. There is an increasingly pronounced trend in favor of a multipolar growth model in lieu of globalization. Of course, building and shaping a new world order, and again, he's using the term, and a lot of people who are fixated on words, they hear a word being used and they don't look at the context, because there's a battle over, we're going to get a new order, okay? We're not going back to globalization. The question is this new order going to be premised around enslavement, or will technology, money, government be in the service of human need? That's the fight. So yeah, he's not a crypto fascist globalist or something, like many say. We will have to confront many challenges, risks, and factors that we can hardly predict or anticipate today. Still, it is obvious that it is up to the strong sovereign states, those that do not follow a trajectory imposed by others, to set the rules governing the New World Order. Only powerful and sovereign states can have their say in this emerging world order. Otherwise, they are doomed to become or remain colonies devoid of any rights. And I'm stopping the sharing right now. But got a bit of a lag.
Matthew.
Yeah.
What can I say? And what can the audience say except eternal gratitude to all your fantastic work? One of the comments of the viewers that you're speaking so close to what quantum morphogenetic science talks about. And that means just being, you know, in that, not a God particle, but a source particle. And they talk all about source facing. So basically, I and all of us would like to thank you again and again. And we acknowledge that, as you have emphasized, that we are co-creators, and that co-creativity, and in that with the eternal embrace and absolute humility and absolute love and absolute forgiving and only in absolute service to the eternal source. We thank you, and we temporarily end this podcast and episode. But before we end, please invite them, Matthew, to where they could really follow you more, and all the books and signed signature and PDFs, etc. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. They can go to, and thank you again for hosting these really nice little educational seminars. I think it's really great that you have a community that's really just pursuing discoveries, and that's so healthy. They can go to risingtidefoundation.net for some of our educational science, cultural stuff. And we do seminars every week as well, Sundays. Cynthia just did a really great series on C.S. Lewis and his battle against the transhumanists in his science fiction trilogy, which is just wonderful. The part three is going to be up by tonight. Really extraordinary. If people haven't read C.S. Lewis's science trilogy on That Hideous Strength and Paralandra and Out of the Silent Planet, oh, shoot, amazing. Like, really nailing the entire Yuval Harari Davos satanic ideology really well. Super strong stuff. Anyway, so that's a Rising Tide Foundation. If they want to buy books, you know, Cynthia and I have co-written seven books, and those are all available on canadianpatriot.org. Our Substacks are also our bread and butter. So if people want to get a paid subscription, that helps a lot. If not, there's free stuff too. Otherwise, yeah, I mean, I went on a little bit longer than I put this PowerPoint together like an hour. I woke up at 11:30 and I was like, I need images. So I put it together really kind of really fast. And I was hoping to have more time for maybe some dialogue and interplay, which we often do a bit more of. And maybe the next time I come around, we won't do a slideshow. We'll just have a back and forth. But I hope that I answered the question in terms of a little bit in terms of what I think the weakness is and what the power is to destroy the satanic force in some way. I hope I did that.
Yeah, no, we appreciate anything that you do, and we're not stuck with any particular format. And as long as, as you said, as we can continue to co-create, and then the viewers and all of us continue to learn, we're with you however you want to have the conversation. Okay.
Cool. All right. Well, guys, it was a pleasure. Bye. Bye.
Thanks.
Ciao.
And remember,
Don't give away your power to anyone else. Be the creator of your own life. You can find more inspiring episodes on 14 different platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, and empoweredhealth.com. Be a part of Thrive Tribes. Be the change in Thrivevolution at thrivetribehub.com. And join me and my fellow changemakers at Health Tribe, Body, Mind, and Soul on Facebook. Spiral up, spiral out.